I represent the appellant in this case, Ms. Lindsay Ray Sheltrack Miller. This appeal derives from a case that had a tragic outcome that my client never wanted or imagined would happen. But the evidence in this case, the record, shows that this case was not a murder, it was self-defense. It's my contention in this appeal that the district court, in conducting this bench trial, misinterpreted and or at the very least misapplied the law relating to first aggressor, withdrawal, and duty to retreat. This case, as I believe the district court noted in its findings of fact and order, can be looked at as a whole or divided into parts, since my first effort at familiarizing myself with it, I have tended to look at it as divided into essentially two parts. The portion before my client was pinned to the ground and the part after that. To me, the part before my client was pinned. This was nothing more than an almost garden variety domestic dispute between a man and a woman, extremely upset with each other, not conducting themselves in a very constructive or healthy way. But somehow, the district court grafted onto my client less than half the size of her male antagonist the quality of first aggressor, when prior to her being pinned, she was mostly on the retreat from Mr. Berge, who kept coming.
Counsel, I'm not sure I agree with you on that. I watched that video several times, and she repeatedly, and the district court found that she repeatedly engaged him, throwing water on him several times, going after him several times. He actually retreated several times. He retreated and he went to his car to fix the tire. He went over across the alley to the other side of the street. And the third time before the final altercation, after she pulled out her mace, she chased after him. He went into the alley. She went after him. And then she said she was feeling ballsy, her term, and she chased after him, tried to mace him, and then she grabbed him. She grabbed him before they went down to the ground. So I'm not sure how the district court's findings that she was the initial aggressor, whether you break it up into three or four parts or two parts or look at the whole, I'm not sure how the district court's finding that she was the initial aggressor is wrong.
Well, that is a lot to respond to. I gather Your Honor had a similar question, and if I can, I will. What my argument was built on is, what is a first aggressor in a murder case? All of these actions that you yourself just described, Your Honor, that my client took, simply walking back towards Mr. Berge, him retreating for whatever reason.
I mean, just to be clear, not simply walking toward him. I mean, chasing him across the alley with a can of mace.
That happened one time, Judge. He chased her far more than she chased him. And the chase that she did at the end of this sequence.
You do know we have the recording.
I do. The chase that she did at the end of the sequence, where, as you said, she grabbed him, was after he had hit her in the head with a can and pushed her.
After she threw the can at him.
As she was retreating. Okay.
And after she punched him.
As she was retreating from him, he was advancing on her. I'll note from the record that even before that, just when he got up the first time and was rolling up his sleeves, even Investigator Hoard testified, that is a sign of somebody who is getting ready to fight. There simply was
correct.
No...
After she was
squirted
throwing
him
water,
with water
at him.
That's the most glaring factual discrepancy here between what could be a first aggressor. I found one case. I looked for something from the criminal sphere and didn't find it, but the Chosa case that I relied on, where it was about an OFP for a parent and a child, the biggest accusation was that the parent ran the child under running water. This court in Chosa said that pouring water on somebody, unless it's scalding, not only is not an assault, it doesn't even have assault of intent. It is harmless.
We're not talking, though, assault. What we're talking about is provocation and aggression, something more than just mere words. And when you look, certainly the two of them were engaged in a verbal altercation, but I find it hard to believe that that didn't escalate the verbal altercation by her actions.
It escalated physically and violently due to the actions of Mr. Berge. My client was having a domestic dispute with her partner, who was demeaning her and doing other things that she suspected him of that had her upset. But I looked at the video too. The only physical acts that my client took were the water and the things she did while she was retreating from the advancing Mr. Berge.
She followed him across the alley with a can of mace to spray him. That's not aggressive?
At the end of that sequence, and let me just point out what didn't happen in that sequence, if I may, Your Honor. She had already pulled out the mace before and not used it, according to the district court's findings. If anything, that conveys an intent that she was warning him, stop attacking me. After he shoved her and hit her in the head with the can, yes, she chased him across the alley. Something else evident from that video, she clearly could outrun Mr. Berge. If she had wanted to attack him, it would have been simple to simply catch up to him and finally start using her fists.
Well, she did catch up with him, and she didn't use her fists. She used the mace.
No, she didn't strike him, and she didn't use the mace. It also would have been very simple.
But she did run up to him. She grabbed him, and she tried to turn him around so she could use the mace on him. And that actually brings up another point, and I realize this is a separate issue, but I think it's related, is she certainly had the opportunity to retreat. When he went into the alley, she could have just gone into her house. He didn't have keys to get into her house. So why didn't she retreat? Instead of retreating, she went on the attack.
The last point I'll make for now on the first aggressor issue is that she could have used the mace when she caught up to him, and she didn't.
I think she did. Didn't she use it on him when they were on the ground?
She did.
It looked like she sprayed him twice, in fact.
Which, again, was the second part of this incident when she was pinned.
After she was the aggressor.
I will continue to dispute that characterization because...
I'm sure you will, counsel.
Let's just look at the
cases. Can I ask you a 30,000-foot question that I didn't see addressed? It seemed to me that one of the issues that maybe it was in the trial, and I didn't look at the trial transcript. I didn't see any analysis in the district court's findings of fact or in the party's arguments on appeal on the question of whether or not, even if she could invoke, even if the district court were wrong about whether she could properly invoke self-defense, the question of whether the degree of force that she used was reasonably proportionate or whether it was unreasonable as a basis to remove the defense. And so I didn't see an analysis in the district court. I'm wondering whether it was argued in the district court.
His order essentially addresses that. You'll recall that the second and third factors involved in finding how there was grounds for her to have reasonable belief of harm and fear that he would harm her.
But that's a different question.
Well,
the fact that you're concerned about harm differs from the question of whether the response was disproportionate.
I think
a stabbing in the chest. There was the question, I think, well, you could have stabbed her in the leg, or could have stabbed him in the leg.
Yes.
Maybe that would have been more proportionate if she could. Anyway, I don't want to take you off track because it wasn't argued by the parties, but I'm curious whether it was an issue raised in the district court.
But he did make that finding, and as you may recall, I addressed that in my brief by pointing out that she was already dealing with someone 2.5 times her size, who was outraged and high on meth. It seems to me that if she had used the knife to stab him in the leg while he was already on top of her, it just would have further antagonized and enraged him. The other point on that, again, now in phase two when she's pinned, My client testified that she warned him that she had a knife first. And this can allow me to segue, perhaps for now we can leave behind the first aggressor part. Assuming for the sake of argument, you could say she was a first aggressor, even though her actions do not compare in any way to the cases the district court relied on for that. There was an effort to withdraw. Even though she was physically pinned, she testified that she warned him she had the knife, and he continued to attack her. The district court did not dispute that finding. Indeed, the district court did not dispute any of my client's testimony. He simply found that her antagonizing him before she was pinned made her a first aggressor. And this is what is so disturbing to me, because if you look in the first sequence in isolation, and it's a domestic dispute, it seems to me very wrong that a smaller woman in a domestic dispute situation with a man gigantic in size and strength compared to hers forfeits her right to defend her life because she squirted him with water and threw stuff at him while he was coming at her? He was the one rolling up his sleeves. He's the one that hit her with things and shoved her first. This is a dangerous way to allow a case like this to say, okay, if you fight back by squirting someone with water or perhaps running after them, you forfeit your right to defend yourself if he gets you in a position where he can squeeze the life out of you. That is wrong. That is wrong. She attempted to withdraw, and I think that that fact was not disputed, Your Honor. And then that would lead me to the duty to retreat unless you have another question.
You know, I realize that we only have 3 minutes left, and I hate to do this to you, but I want to shift gears quickly to the second issue you raised. Because
sentencing?
I think we're looking at a relatively new statute, only passed in 2021.
Yes.
There doesn't seem to be much case law on that. But you argue that the rehabilitative efforts, it appears you don't argue that she did not engage in rehabilitative efforts. I think your argument is more focused on whether or not it's required under the statute. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. And it is a new statute, and I actually deal with it all the time because I work in veterans court every week. It's a treatment court, and that's another part of the statute. It's the first time I've dealt with the sentencing aspect as well. But the thing that I found most obvious was my argument is a big part of it, and is that I think the district court really didn't exercise the discretion that this statute called for. It's why I illustrated the legislative history, the intent behind the entire Restorative Justice Act, that the legislature seemed to have it in mind that veterans would be considered differently when it came to sentencing for crimes, especially related to trauma they suffered while they were in the military. My client was sexually assaulted in the military. She was assaulted repeatedly by Mr. Berge. There was no consideration of that.
I'm not so sure about that. I think the district court actually did acknowledge that and did say she was, and that those elements are met. But when I look at the statute, and in particular in Subdivision 4 on the sentencing, Subdivision 4B, where it talks about engaging in rehabilitative efforts, and it says, if the court determines that the defendant has engaged in substantial rehabilitative efforts and that the defendant establishes by clear and convincing evidence three other elements, and it says the court may, given the court discretion, order a mitigated durational or dispositional sentencing departure.
Yes.
And you argue that you rely on, I think it was a 1982 case, to say it doesn't apply to dispositional departures, but it seems like the plain language of the statute does say that in this particular case that it does apply to either a durational or a dispositional sentencing departure.
Well, and Your Honor, because this is a new statute, I think it hasn't been interpreted yet. And, of course, that's the role of the appellate courts. And I'm not just relying on that 1982 case, but there is a consistent body of case law for the last 40 years, most of it non-precedential, that holds that when it comes to a durational departure, rehabilitative efforts, A durational departure is not about the offender. It's about the offense.
Right, and I understand that, but how do you get around the plain language of the statute that it seems that it applies to both?
By assigning it the interpretation that would be consistent with this court's case law for the last 40 years and the sentencing guidelines, which has the same language.
But the legislature can say, I understand what the courts have said, but we're going to say something new here.
I think that the way that statute is written, it's also not the only interpretation that it's susceptible to. The ambiguity is created, if nothing else, by the body of case law restricting rehabilitative efforts from durational departure considerations. If there's ambiguity in the statute, this court has to apply it consistent not just with the legislative intent, but the overall effect of its purpose, sentencing. Rehabilitative efforts do not go to durational departures, which is all my client specifically requested. I wish I could talk more about the issues in this case.
You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal time.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Lydia Villalba-Lijo, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota. It is undisputed that appellant fatally stabbed JB. What this court needs to decide is whether appellant could validly claim that she acted in self-defense. The district court concluded that appellant did not act in self-defense because, one, there was no absence of aggression or provocation on the part of appellant, and two, there was no absence of a reasonable possibility of retreat to avoid the danger.
If we break this incident up into parts, how could she have reached, and assuming that the last part was Ms. Sheltrack Miller being on the ground, how could she have retreated?
I was just about to address that, Your Honor. And to suggest to the court that the critical point, that the most relevant point to decide the issue that's before the court is the point where JB breaks off the confrontation and begins running down the alley away.
Right, but I wanted you to, for my question, assume that I'm looking at this in segments and that the last segment, the significant segment, was when Ms. Sheltrack Miller was on the ground Mr. Berg is over her. On what basis would the district court assume a duty to retreat at that moment? And if so, how could she have retreated?
Well, I disagree with the premise of the question, but I'm going to do my best to answer it.
The premise being that it was a separate segment?
No, the purpose, okay, so your question is, once she's on the ground with with JB leaning over her legs, did she have a duty to retreat? How could she have retreated? At that point, probably the most, she has created a very difficult and dangerous situation for herself and for JB at that point. Consistent with Belcourt versus State, probably what she could have done that would have salvaged or indicated a retreat and salvaged her right to self-defense at that point would have been to say, stop, let's just stop and not threaten him with a knife. Now, in Belcourt, that defendant...
She hadn't drawn the knife yet.
She had not drawn her knife.
She's on the ground. He's standing over her. He could walk away.
Standing over her.
And instead of walking away, he walks toward her within range, and she starts kicking him away, and he drops down on top of her. At any point during that exchange, I'm trying to fathom a person on the ground having either a duty or the opportunity to retreat.
She had, from what you've just described, which is a little bit different than what you had previously described, so he is not down on the ground yet. He has pulled her to the ground. She is on the ground. She's kicking him. And interestingly, he somewhat turns and begins picking up items in the alley. He's not punching her. He's not kicking her back. He's picking up items in the alley. She's kicking him. Opportunity to leave. Opportunity to get up and run away. Now he begins to lean down, he kneels down, and she maces him at that point. And then they start to struggle over the mace, and they are struggling over her right hand. He is grabbing her right hand because he wants to pry the mace away from her at that point. And this is all consistent with her, with the judge's findings, and consistent with her testimony in trial. So while he was standing up, bless you, Your Honor, she had an opportunity to run off at that point or say, stop, quit.
She's on the ground and he's standing over her.
He's standing over her, but he's not fighting her at that moment. He is picking up items from the ground. He is not kicking her. He is not punching her. He's not, everything that JB does is in response to appellant's aggression. Once she's on the ground, she continues to kick while he is more interested in picking up the items that have fallen on the ground as he fled into the alley. He is not
But he's not moving away from her to pick up those things. He's standing immediately over her.
He's standing nearby, but he is not engaging her in the fight. She's engaging him in the fight.
It appears aggressive. I'm just going to suggest to you that his standing over her appears to be aggressive. I think the district court, it seems like the district court got it right when it says these people are both going at it with each other. But I was just curious if you'd broken it apart. And can you answer the question I asked earlier? If we were to hold that Ms. Sheltrack Miller was entitled to defend herself with force, what do we do with that as a remedy? Did the district court ever have before it the question of whether the force that she used was reasonable and proportionate in relation to her perceived fear or the threat?
That's a very good question. The judge did not make a finding on the reasonableness of the force that was used.
The issue presented to the district court
the by issue the, is by the state? The issue is discussed in a memorandum that is submitted to the district court. The party submitted written closing arguments.
And by the state. The state made the argument that it wasn't reasonable, the force wasn't reasonable?
I am confident of that. I have the document with me.
So what would be the remedy if we were to agree that she was entitled to assert self-defense?
Well, first, I feel compelled to urge the court not to
reach that finding. I understand that. It's just a hypothetical assumption.
I was evaluating that just that question this morning. If this court were to find that she did have the right of self-defense, we do not have a finding from the district court on the reasonableness of the force used. So likely then, one remedy for this court to consider is to remand it to the district court for a finding on that issue. That's an important issue, is whether that the force that was used was reasonable. I would like to address the absence. First, I would like to address the absence of a reasonable possibility of retreat to avoid the danger. Now, after the confrontation escalated, and the beginning point here is when JB runs into the alley, as fast as he appears to be able to go, he even loses a shoe running into the alley. Now, after the confrontation escalated...
Well, I don't know if it's because of speed. I mean, I got the impression from the autopsy report that perhaps both of these individuals were under the influence of methamphetamines. They appear to be clumsy.
They are both under the influence of methamphetamine. The autopsy established that for JB, and appellant testified to that at trial. But after the confrontation escalated, appellant and JB had thrown a soda can at each other, JB ran down the alley. Appellant at that point had several avenues of retreat available to her. First, she was literally steps away from her home. She could have clearly sought safety there. She had keys to her home. JB did not. She also could have hopped into her car, which was very close to her at that point, Her car was also operable, and she could easily have gotten into her car and driven away.
So JB, it really gets on the other hand, I don't disagree with anything you're saying. I think that's the record supports it. But it kind of gets back to the point that appellant's counsel was making, and that is it depends on what the relevant, you know, at what point do you view the ability to retreat? And it seems to me that once she is on the ground under the victim's body weight, there is no ability to retreat.
Well, and Your Honor,
and why isn't that the point at which we should be analyzing the question of self-defense?
Thank you for giving me that opportunity. That was just where I wanted to go with that. Now, appellant has relied on State versus Austin to argue that appellant's duty to retreat arose only at the moment when JB was holding her to the ground. But Austin does not support appellant's interpretation. Austin instead makes it clear that a defendant does not act in self-defense when he has options or she has options for escape or avoiding the danger and chooses to act aggressively. The facts in Austin are a bit complicated, but they are relevant here. An armed defendant engaged in a violent confrontation in which there was a pause and several options available to the defendant. And here's what the Supreme Court said about the duty to retreat in those circumstances. The duty relates, and I'm sorry, it's a little bit long, but I think it's important. The duty relates to defendant's election to kill, making a killing unjustified if danger was reasonably avoidable. Several options for escape or avoidance of peril were available to defendant rather than directly confronting Royster and Johnson. Defendant could have remained in the restroom or gone back to the bar area or otherwise waited until Royster and Johnson had left. He also could have departed through the back exit. The jury could well have believed that these were reasonable options and that defendant made an aggressive choice to confront Johnson at the front entrance. Now, the court also notes that the defendant had reasonable options to avoid danger prior, and I would underscore that, prior to his confrontation. In Austin, as in this case, there were several options for avoiding the danger, but appellant instead made an aggressive choice to chase JB and continue the physical fight. Appellant's argument also raises concerns from a public policy point of view. In State versus Devens, the Supreme Court noted that if there was no duty to retreat from a confrontation taking place just outside of the defendant's home, the court would be encouraging unnecessary and dangerous confrontations, and the same is true here. Adopting appellant's interpretation would encourage dangerous and unnecessary confrontations. Jumping back to Austin, there's another way to think about it that is also supportive of the state's position here. The court approved the following description of the duty to retreat. Before you can avail yourself of self-defense, you must retreat and avoid the danger if you can reasonably do so. If you can reasonably avoid it, you must retreat and avoid the danger.
When did the confrontation between these parties become dangerous, as you understand the record?
I would say that it becomes the most dangerous after the soda cans are thrown and JB begins to run down the alley. Now, it's dangerous throughout. There's no dispute in the record that appellant was extremely angry. She was very, very angry at JB. Him having his four vehicle tires flattened wouldn't have helped anything. It seems that appellant may have been up all night. There was some texting or communicating that was going on. JB arrives at the home in the morning. When he goes to leave, he finds out that the tires are flattened. So this is kind of a escalating, volatile situation that doesn't get any better. As noted, appellant had at least two times When she's immediately out of the car, she approaches JB while he is trying to focus on fixing one of the flats, and then she later reapproaches him while he is crouched down. And that exchange results in that back and forth there, and I don't mean to minimize that in any way with that phrase, but that back and forth results finally in the soda can being thrown back and forth, and with JB clearly wanting to break off this confrontation and take off down the alley.
Counsel, there's less than a minute left. I want to ask you quickly about 609.1056, the Military Veteran Crime Act. And, you know, there's language in there about engaging rehabilitative efforts and that the court may order a mitigated durational or dispositional sentencing departure. But isn't that language contrary to what we look at with respect to durational versus dispositional departures? Isn't that at a minimum ambiguous? Because that doesn't really seem to be applicable to both.
I think that it's intended to give the court some sentencing discretion. You know, clearly there's the whole body of case law with durational departures having to do with the severity of the offense. But as was noted during my colleague's argument, it's a brand new law. It hasn't been interpreted. I would, there is a non-precedential case. I'll just close with this. I see that I'm out of time.
You can quickly finish, yes.
There's a non-precedential 2022 case that addresses 609.1055, and it went into some detail. 1055 also has to do with sentencing and military veterans. There's some discussion in that case, and that is State versus Tony Hewitt, H-E-W-I-T-T. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Counsel for Appellant, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal. You frightened them all away.
Paul Maravilli, again, for Appellant Lindsay Sheltrack Miller. If I may begin, the duty to retreat argument that I argue in my brief does focus on Austin and Edwards, cases 25 years apart, where the Supreme Court has held multiple times that this duty does not arise until the election to kill, or as I pointed out from Sanders in 85, also the election to defend. Devens helps because it points out that this duty relates to when the defendant has to make a decision to prevent the harm feared. So to me, in this record, I believe the district court misapplied the duty to retreat from my client to any point prior to when she took the knife out of the bag, which I would reemphasize here was when she was pinned, not just when Mr. Berge was standing over her. So it is at that moment. And I think Austin presents a good example. The court didn't focus on the fracas that happened before he went into the bathroom. They focused on the fact that he then came out and re-confronted them. It was at that point that he had a duty to retreat because of any harm that he still feared from these people, but he chose to, I think it was shoot them or otherwise kill them. I don't remember how.
How do you respond to Respondent's Counsel's argument that for us to conclude that your client acted in self-defense would encourage dangerous and unnecessary confrontations?
I'm not sure the context that argument was placed in, whether it relates to the domestic that happened before and the first aggressor issue or about the duty to retreat.
But I think it was when discussing the duty to retreat. Well,
that this case could not be further away from that speculative prospect put forward by respondent. This was a moment where, again, my client was pinned by a 306-pound man.
But arguably a moment she placed herself into and didn't have to be in.
You know, I disagree, Your Honor. He's the one that pulled her to the ground and then straddled her and pinned her. So it depends on what you say as far as Whether she intended to put herself into a position not to be able to retreat, I don't think so.
But doesn't that ignore the fact that she chased after him while he was running away from her, and she grabbed him before he pulled her to the ground?
And, Your Honor, at that point, the moment there where there was any evidence or aspect to indicate that she was contemplating a decision to harm, perhaps fatally, was not there.
Well, at a minimum, she intended to mace him.
And that's more about the first aggressor issue, Your Honor. And if I am not going to prevail on that, then again, I will maintain that there was withdrawal here, which I think the district court just kind of skipped over because, again, he did not dispute her testimony that she warned him she had the knife before she pulled it out. The proportionality of the response, I really want to talk about that because the situation here is, I think, clear that she was unable to retreat at that moment, if that is the moment when the duty to retreat was there. So, again, she not only was having...
How does that go to the proportionality of the response?
Well, I'm getting to that.
Okay.
Because she only at that moment had to make the election to kill or defend herself, and she was unable to leave. What degree of force was necessary to stop a rampaging, meth-addled man 2.5 times her size to hopefully not beat her, strangle her, or do some other egregious harm?
Are you suggesting that we could determine as a matter of law that if we agreed with your argument that she had there was a basis for self-defense, that the degree of force that she used was... sufficient, that it didn't exceed, as a matter of law, did not exceed what would be a reasonable response?
Yes, Your Honor. I am definitely saying that. Because
but how would we, as a matter of procedure, how could we do that since the district court didn't address that issue and it was raised by the state?
I could only submit that the degree of force used was appropriate given the extreme size and strength mismatch, the fact that she was pinned and couldn't move, and that she
No, I mean, I know that's the argument. I'm wondering, as a matter of procedure, how would we reach that conclusion if the district court didn't make a finding on it?
I think it goes back to the original error that the district court first placed a duty to retreat on my client far before it arose. He also called her the first aggressor, and therefore she forfeited her self-defense to begin with. So that is probably why he didn't feel the need to address the proportionality of the force used, because he already deprived her of her self-defense before that. The proportionality...
Right, I think that goes to my question. So why wouldn't we... I guess what I'm asking is, if you are correct, if we agree with you, wouldn't the remedy be to remand to the district court to issue a finding, make a determination as to whether the force used was reasonable?
Your Honor, I of course know you have... that option, the authority to do so.
Wouldn't that be I'm just wondering, as a matter of procedure, wouldn't we be required to do it?
I've gotten to know Judge Welty a little bit over the last 6 months. I think he would probably point out that he did talk about it when he noted that Ms. Sheltrack Miller in her testimony admitted, no, I didn't try to stab him in the leg or the shoulder. See, that I think was his way of addressing that there could have been a lesser proportion of force used, which is why I felt the need to point out that if she had done that, it would have just further enraged him. And she was pinned. She was helpless at that point. So if that's the moment duty to retreat comes down to, as I believe the law dictates, it wasn't there. She couldn't exercise it.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. Tragic circumstances, very unfortunate with two individuals, for both of them going forward. We will take the matter under advisement as submitted on this date and issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you both. Thank you.